Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here and talk about my favourite subject, which is what I call the opens, because, as the introduction so wisely said, the interesting things that are happening now are that the ideas of open source are being applied elsewhere. And in fact, I'm not really going to talk about open source at all this evening. So, even though you're an open source interest group, I hope you'll be interested in the other things, because a lot is happening. I'm sure you've come across all of these things, but I just want to draw together a few threads outside the open source world and relate it to what's happening in the open source world. First of all, I'd like to pose a question. As you probably know, Tim O'Reilly likes to pose a question sometimes at some of the conferences that he talks at. He asks people, who here uses open source? And this tends to be in a slightly more sort of general computing environment. Of course, you know, about one person puts their hand up. And then he asks, you know, who uses Google? And everybody puts their hand up, and he says, oh, well, you see, you're using open source and you don't know it. So I'd like to repose the question and say, who here uses open source, not including Google? In other words, real open source. So who here uses open source? Okay, that's pretty much what I expect. And, I mean, who uses it sort of every instant of their working lives? Yep. In fact, I go further than that. Not only do you use it every instant of your working lives, you use it every instant of your non-working lives and every instant of your non-conscious lives. And the reason I say that is because life itself, DNA, is open source. And so let's talk a little bit about what I call open genomics. The genome, I mean, everyone knows the word. The genome refers to the totality of the DNA within a cell. So it's not just about the genes, which is what one normally talks about, but it refers to all of it. And there's a heck of a lot of it. There are about 3 billion letters, genomic letters, which are traditionally represented by A, C, G, and T in the complete genome of the human. The A, C, G, and T refer, as you probably know, to the chemicals. Adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine. But what's really interesting is that these letters are actually a quaternary system for encoding information. It's not their physical or analog properties that matter. It's their information content. And the interesting thing is that nature has decided to use a quaternary system rather than a binary system. But in fact, they're completely equivalent, as you can see. You could just do a mapping from A to 00 and C to 01 and so on. So there's no actual difference. And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious why you have to have a digital information system at the heart of life. Because if you have an analog one, you really don't have the fidelity that you need for reproduction. It's the old problem that when you copy something on a photocopier and copy the copy and copy the copy of the copy, you end up with a kind of grey smudge. So we wouldn't be here. We'd just be a grey smudge if we were analog beings. But in fact, we're profoundly digital beings because the DNA encodes using a digital information system. And one way of thinking about this is that genomes are a bit like GNU/Linux distributions. They're very complex packages of smaller elements. The collections of applications, which you can think of the genes as being subroutines of those applications. And in fact, the DNA that you get between the genes is really like the kind of coding that calls on those subroutines. And it's only now that people are beginning to understand that what's traditionally been called junk DNA is actually far from it. In fact, it's where most of the richness is. The genes are actually the simplest bits. The really interesting stuff is actually between the genes. So you've got a very interesting sort of mapping between genomes and source code and proteins and subroutines there. I said that DNA is open source. Well, we've looked at the kind of software side of it, so we better look at the open side of it. I'm sure everyone's heard of the Human Genome Project. This was a $3 billion project to sequence the human genome, which, as I said, had 3 billion DNA letters in it. And it was completed in draft form around about 2001 and is almost finished now in terms of the final version. And what's interesting about the project is that it was essentially global and distributed. It wasn't a centralized attempt, say, like the Manhattan Project, to do something with one big center. It consisted of tens or even hundreds of centers around the world doing their little bit. And what proved to be the breakthrough in terms of making the Human Genome Project possible was the internet. until the net came along, there was almost no way to compare your results with those of other centres. And in particular, there's no way of seeing what other people had done and doing the bit they hadn't done. So in other words, there was lots of duplication. But when the net came along and they started to create databases with centralised stores of genomic information, then the Human Genome Project really took off. And it took off for all the reasons that open source works. In other words, the ability to do this kind of distributed development process, the ability to work anywhere in the world, the ability to compare what you're doing with other people, and also the Darwinian dynamics which you get with open source projects, whereby if you have small elements and you can produce something better, you can slot in the better and take out the worse. The better and the worse is to do with the quality, really, that people are able to work on bits of the genome, and even if it had been done before, if they came up with a better quality result in terms of the accuracy, then they could slot that in. So it basically worked such that everybody could collaborate in the ways that open source traditionally does. So there are some very clear parallels, I think. The freeness, that was the dynamics really, but the freeness of genomic sequences is by no means something that one could take for granted. In fact, until 1996, it wasn't at all clear that the human DNA was actually going to be freely available for anyone to look at. There was a race between the Human Genome Project and particularly a company called Celera, which was set up with the express intention of sequencing the human genome and patenting as much of it as possible. So it would have been taking the human genome out of the public domain. And the main thing that stopped that, really, was a declaration amongst all the parties taking part in the Human Genome Project in 1996 that came to be known as the Bermuda Declaration, where, as it's written here, it was agreed that all human genomic sequence information generated by the Centre funded for large-scale human end sequencing should be freely available and in the public domain in order to encourage research and development and maximise its benefit to society. And obviously, once something's in the public domain, depending a little bit on the patent system, it should stop companies from patenting it, because it means that the patenting fails one of the tests. So it was a very important statement that anything produced by the Human Genome Project would immediately go into the public domain, and therefore it would essentially create a commons in the genomic content. And this was mainly driven by Sir John Thulston, who was profoundly concerned about the idea that human DNA might be patented, and therefore he and a couple of other people really pushed this through in 1996. And it's really largely due to him and the people that sort of backed him that we do have an open source DNA and not a closed source DNA. I mean, Celera is essentially the Microsoft of the genomics world. Their statement was, you know, we're going to make money by patenting everything and you pay for it, and that was their business model. But again, very much like the open source world, once you produce something that's in the public domain, then your business model based around exclusivity just falls to pieces. And so Celera tried for a while, after they succeeded in sequencing the human genome, to sell subscriptions to their databases. But after about a year or two, they just gave up, because what's the point of, you know, paying for an expensive web server when you can use Apache? What's the point of paying Celera for a subscription to their human genome when you can get the public domain genome, which after all differs only in sort of details? And so it's a very good example, I think, of how the same dynamics that we see in open source in terms of impacting business models also came to play in the area of genomics. So just comparing the two worlds here, you can see they're very closely aligned. So you've got a digital code. In one case it's binary, in one case it's quaternary, but that's really just a mathematical difference. In the case of open genomics, you only have the source code, whereas the open source world you have source and object. And the reason for that is that we are the object code, so you don't really need the object code. It is free. It's free as in beer and in freedom. You can get it for nothing. You can go to one of the three main databases. There's one in the US, one in the UK, and one in Japan. And you can just download all of it. There are no barriers. You just go there, download it. And it's free as in freedom. You can do whatever you like with it. You can, you know, invent wonderful drugs, you can just do analysis, you can turn it into wallpaper, I mean, whatever you want, so it's truly free. And then in terms of the dynamics of the two worlds, both were really global projects, both were distributed, they're net-based, and there's this Darwinian element. So I think that the match between the open genomics and the open source are really is really quite close. Now, the next area I want to go on to, the match isn't quite so close, but there's some very interesting similarities, and in particular, the culture surrounding it is very similar. So the next area I want to talk about is open access. And by that I mean digital versions of academic research. So this is traditional literature which normally appears in journals, generally published without expectation of payment by the researchers. Now, the fact that the researchers do the work, they do the editing, and they actually buy this journal, doesn't mean that the companies that produce the journals don't make a lot of money. There are some journals that cost around $20,000 a year for a subscription. And all of this content is produced free of charge by the academics. It's edited, it's subbed, it's checked, everything is free of charge, and then the companies, who are typically large publishing companies, then sell subscriptions back to the people, very often, who have done the work. So a lot of people thought that that wasn't really fair. And therefore, the open access movement doesn't seek to change the underlying academic model. In other words, it's still based on peer review, and this is one of the great misconceptions that a lot of enemies of open access put about, that open access is about publishing anything. Nothing can be further from the truth. It's using the traditional academic model, but with the major proviso that the results are published free of charge. So anybody can go to a website, because we're talking about digital versions online. This is not about the hard copy versions, because obviously there are real costs involved in that. But the digital versions, the costs are far lower. So we're talking about free as in beer. You get free access to these websites. But it's not generally free as in freedom. In other words, there are usually still various kinds of copyright applying to those texts. So there's a varying ability to use and change that text. And in some ways, that's not surprising, really, because scientists have worked on these results, and they don't really want people to take their results and then start, you know, people start using their words in out of context or changing their words. I mean, there needs to be a certain integrity, and that's quite an important issue for the open access world. But the point is, it's still a radical change from what has currently been the case in terms of these extremely expensive traditional journals. So let's look a bit more of this. What I find interesting about the open access world is that there is the same kind of tension, admittedly slightly more muted, that you find in the open source world between the kind of free software side and the open source side. In other words, the kind of purists and the pragmatists. And the purists are sort of led by somebody called Stephen Harnad, who, like Richard Stallman, really had these ideas a long time ago. Back in 1976, he started a journal, a paper journal, with open peer commentary. In other words, inviting people to effectively come up with patches for the stuff that they were reading. Now, obviously, that's not very practical when you've got a paper journal. So he then, in 1989, launched a Usenet Bitnet magazine. So this was an online journal, which was using, you know, the most advanced technology of its time, i.e. Usenet and Bitnet. And this, nowadays, obviously, would be sort of hardly anything special, but it was one of the first to try and get this kind of feedback that we associate with open source. He's a little bit like Richard Stallman in the sense that he has fairly grand ideas. He's not one to sort of compromise. So he writes papers with titles like Post Gutenberg Galaxy, The Fourth Revolution in the Means of Production of Knowledge, or A Subversive Proposal for Electronic Publishing. I mean, he's not interested in just sort of minor tweaks to the system. He really wants to subvert the whole system, rather as Richard Stallman does. And so that's one side of the open access movement. And on the other, you've got Paul Ginsberg, which I'm sure many of you know. In 1991, he just wanted a kind of quick and dirty solution to getting high-energy physics preprints online, because it was quite obvious that the internet was going to be a tremendous medium for transmitting knowledge, but there was no way of doing it. So he just set up a website, archive.org, and basically, without any more ado, just started putting up preprints. Interestingly, this actually happened 9 days before the very first version of Linux was released by Linus. So there was obviously something in the air in 1991 that made people do interesting things. And again, as you probably know, this has now taken off, and it is now the place where all high-energy physics preprints appear, and it is now spreading into other areas. Growing out of that, when more and more people set up these kind of archives, Ginsparg was instrumental in helping set up what's called the Open Archives Initiative, because one of the problems was you were having interoperability problems. And the idea here was to allow people to search across multiple archives. If you're trying to find a particular paper, you don't have to search each one individually. So there's the openness was starting to come into the idea of archives at that point. Shortly after that, some innovative publishers took up the idea. There's this remarkable gentleman called Vitek Trach, who has driven a lot of the most interesting ideas in publishing over the last 10 or 20 years in the kind of biomedical area. And he set up something called Biomed Central, which was remarkable because it adopted this philosophy of making freely available material, which hitherto you'd been paid £5,000 or £10,000 a year. And that has now grown to hundreds of titles and has become an important player in this area. Also very interesting is something called the Public Library of Science. This was set up a little bit later, but it has a slightly more sort of high-profile background to it, in that Patrick Brown, Michael Eisen, and Harold Varmus tried to get this kind of open access idea started within the context of traditional scientific publishing, and the publishers, basically traditional publishers, fought back so sort of violently that they killed that idea completely. So they went off and they managed to get some funding from the Hewlett-Packard Foundation, and using I think about $9 million, they've set up a series of open access titles. The first two are called PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine. Already the first one of these, I think, has the highest impact factor of any biological title, and that's after about 1 year of running. And this is basically because a lot of the top scientists in the world really believe in these ideas and publish here. So its impact factor is incredibly high. And indeed, there's lots of evidence to show, for obvious reasons, that open access titles tend to have higher impact factors than traditional ones, because more people read you. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious reason, really. There are now about 10 of these PLOS titles. There's now PLOS Computational Biology, which they've recently started. And they're doing a lot of very innovative things. what's interesting in particular is that Patrick Brown and Michael Eisen were inspired very directly by the example of the genome databases we talked about, the archive.org project, and open source software. I mean, I spoke to Patrick Brown when I was writing my last book, and he says that open source was one of the things that gave him the inspiration to push this through. I mean, he saw how well it worked in open source. So it's interesting that this is a direct effect, really, of the open source world. Interestingly, it wasn't called open access for the first 10 or 20 years. And it's a little bit like free software and open source. I mean, open source didn't exist as a term until 1998. And something called the Budapest Open Access Initiative is perhaps the best definition of what open access entails. And from that time on, people started using this kind of marketing phrase, open access, in the same way that people started using open source after it was coined at the Freeware Summit in 1998. So again, there's quite an interesting parallel there. As I say, just looking at the how open access works, it's a global phenomenon. You have open access materials stored in open archives found all around the world. It's distributed. The Open Archives Initiative is designed to allow searching across the archives using the various harvesting protocols that have been designed. The net is absolutely integral to using open access, because it frees you from the cost of producing paper-based journals. It's not really directly Darwinian in the same way that open genomics and open source are. although one hopes that academic search is Darwinian in the sense that it's supposed to get better rather than just sort of go in different directions, the open access texts aren't improved in a directly sort of Darwinian way, so that it's not quite parallel. So look at these here. You've got basically similarities apart from this Darwinian side and the freedom aspect, that open access gives you the freedom as in beer, but not necessarily freedom as in freedom, because there are usually restrictions on what you can do with the text. It depends a little bit on the particular area. Okay, so we just talked about a particular kind of text within the kind of scientific context, but obviously not all text is born in that scientific context or academic context. There's lots of other textual content, and the open content movement is really about freeing up that text and also other forms of content, which includes graphics, music and video. And the pioneer here, again going back an incredibly long way, 1971, Michael Hart started what he called Project Gutenberg, and he started it by typing the Declaration of Independence into a mainframe using some spare time that he was given. He then tried to top his achievement in creating the first kind of open content by also creating the first spam message, because he tried to send that to everybody on ARPANET. Luckily he was stopped before that happened, because that would have been a bit of a sad achievement to actually spam everybody even before the internet was born. Another interesting parallel, apart from the personal ones, I don't know if anyone's ever come across Michael Hart or seen anything, but he is a very driven person, rather like Richard Stallman. It was also a project a bit like GNU that was quite slow to get going. In 1991, 20 years after he started, they'd only managed to convert 10 books into the kind of open content format, which was basically taking a physical book and typing it in, producing a digital version. So it was an incredibly slow process. Partly it was because they had very high standards. I mean, they proof-checked these things multiple times. But also because he was very much, you know, a voice crying in the wilderness. People just thought he was nuts, and he just sat in his room typing away. But gradually he got more and more support, until by 2006 there are now 20,000 books which are freely available, essentially as text files, unformatted text files. Some are also HTML. There's now something called the distributed proofreaders, who take the kind of raw text, which now tends to be scanned in. In the old days it was actually typed in directly, but now it's scanned in. And this use, as its name suggests, is distributed, and it tends to use all the kind of open source ideas for checking things. All of these books, with a few exceptions, are in the public domain. So these are works that are completely outside copyright. So there's no legal problems in terms of doing this. And the legal aspect is something that becomes problematic when you're dealing with more recent content. And that really is one of the main threads outside the Project Gutenberg, which, as I say, was very much a pioneer, but is rather limited to books that are outside the copyright. Sorting out the legal code has really been one of the thorny issues, because for material which, for example, if it's been written recently, then it's covered by copyright, and you have to find some way of freeing it from the restrictions of copyright, because basically copyright stops you doing most of the things you would want to do in an open source kind of way. So a lot of the open content thinking was about the legal code, not so much the software code, but the legal side. How do we address those issues? And one of the first people to do that, in fact the person who actually came out with the term open content, something called David Wiley, and he was directly inspired by the coining of this phrase open source at the Freeware Summit in 1998, because he was, I think, a postgraduate studying various kinds of educational uses of technology. And it struck him that if we've got open source, we really should have something called open content. So that the creation of this marketing term open source caused him to think about open content. And in 1998, he drew up, in a very rough form, an open content license. Now, it won't surprise you to learn that because it's legalistic writing, it took a lot of iterations to get anything that was really workable. In fact, he came up with another open publication license, which is rather confusing. because we had the open content license before. And in fact, there are four versions of that, OPL, OPLA, OPLB, and OPLAB. So you're already starting to get into the kind of legalistic problems that are so common nowadays. And I think that shows the problems that open content labours under. It's really legal problems above all else. And so it's not surprising that it took a lawyer, Larry Lessig, to come in and really codify what people were trying to do legally with this stuff. And he drew up a range of licenses, which he called collectively the Creative Commons. And I've put down some of them here. Some of them are just sort of straightforward attribution, but others specify you can do anything you like with it for non-commercial purposes. Others say you can't make derivatives. Others impose a share alike, which is quite like the GNU GPL. Some are pure public domain. There are even ones called developing nations, which have sort of twists for people in developing nations. So this is an even more complex sort of matrix of possibilities, and again reflects the complexity of trying to capture the legal code that is required to make open content possible. Now, one of the primary uses so far of CC licenses has been open education, creating educational materials that are freely available for others to use, because it's obvious if you think about it. I mean, you've got teachers producing the best kind of teaching materials they can, and then essentially another teacher just has to do the same. I mean, it's the old closed source proprietary problem that basically you have to keep inventing word processors, but once it's been done once, what you want to do is make a better one. So the idea here is that you can build on other people's resources to produce better teaching materials. And the two first ones were really the Connections project at Rice, which uses a purely open source platform called Raptos, and the MIT Open Courseware project, which uses a proprietary platform for sort of historical reasons. But interestingly, David Wiley, who is a great believer in open source, has actually come up with an open source version of that proprietary platform. So it's called EduCommons. So there is an open source implementation of that. Just recently, some of you may have seen, the Open University is starting to get in on this. They've created something called OpenLearn, which is exactly the same idea, that the course materials will be made freely available under a CC license. They use a mixture of existing open source software, including Moodle, a course management system, which again I'm sure lots of you know about. And there are lots and lots of other institutions all around the world which are taking these materials, translating them, adapting them. It's an extremely rich area. So I think it's a good example of where open content has really taken off, because it's serving a particular need very well. So I was talking about the legal codes that needed to be negotiated, but obviously there's also the issue of software codes, because what I talked about before was really just taking text, for example, and then dealing with the legal issues surrounding that text. But you might want to do more than just publish texts. You might want to do something a bit more interesting with it. And I think that you can see that blogs and wikis are, in a sense, layering software code on top of the legal codes, because they're trying to do something a bit more. They're not just presenting you with a kind of Project Gutenberg text. They're trying to create more complex documents which require more complex software. So, I mean, the blog stuff is fairly trivial, and yet, if you look at the history of blogs, it was only when things like Blogger and Radio Useland came along that blogging really took off. And yet, the idea of having web pages with entries in reverse chronological order with comments is just pure Web 1.0 technology. I mean, you could have done that in 1991. So there's no real innovation there. And yet, it wasn't until Blogger and Pitters and Radio Useland came along that blogging took off, for the reason that people needed those tools. And similarly, it was when blog search engines like Technorati came along that people started to find blogs useful, rather than just an interesting kind of online diary. They started to become resources, because you could find stuff. And that was really down to Dave Wiener coming up with the idea of this ping, whereby when you make a post, various centralized servers are pinged, and they therefore update their records. So it was small but important technological advances, I think, which made blogs possible. And the same idea with wikis. Again, as I'm sure you know, I mean, Tim Berners-Lee says that he always had a read-write web in mind from the start. It's just that by an accident of history, we ended up with a read-only web. And so putting the writes back in the web through wikis and to a lesser extent through blogs, is really returning to the roots. And it was a matter of the technology catching up with the possibilities. So it was really when Ward Cunningham came up with the WikiWiki web, and people could see how to use technology to do those kind of write webs as well as read webs, that Wikis took off. But again, the idea is actually really fairly trivial. You could have done it in 1991, but it took 5 or 6 years for somebody to think, well, let's just try it, and then for the whole thing to take off. So that's why I put that down under software code. Obviously, the most famous example of open content which requires some kind of technological infrastructure is Wikipedia. Interestingly enough, it uses the GNU free documentation license rather than the Creative Commons ones, which makes it slightly unusual. The Wikimedia Commons, which has images and sounds, has a mixture of GFDL and Creative Commons. Interestingly, Larry Sanger, who is the co-founder of Wikipedia, is now aiming to fork Wikipedia to produce his Citizendium, what he calls a progressive fork of Wikipedia. And I think this is a very good demonstration of the power of the open ideas. As we know, the fork is a very important element within the open source world. And here we're seeing the fork being applied to content. And he believes that he can produce something that is more valuable than the current Wikipedia, because it will take Wikipedia and basically iron out a lot of the bugs in it. So it's a classic kind of open source strategy, that somebody who thinks they can do better, so they fork a project. It'll be interesting to see how he gets on with that. I just put some numbers here just to show the scale of the multimedia open content. This was actually today I got these numbers. This is just looking at Flickr, which is obviously one of the main repositories of open content images. And if you look at the pretty impressive numbers, these by ND, the no distribution, the no derivatives, and the no NC is no commercial. And so these are the different kinds of Creative Commons licenses. You can see that most people put non-commercial as a condition on sharing their images. But even the purely by attribution ones, there's still nearly 3 million of those. And indeed, down the bottom, I got from the Creative Commons site, there are apparently 140 million link backs to Creative Commons licenses. So that includes text, images, whatever, but that's still 140 open content items. I also put down here video, because there's some interesting things happening in this area now. Not so much the things I put on the top, the BBC Creative Archive and the Internet Archive, which tend to be static repositories of just video files that you can use if you want to. But these things here, Elephant's Dream and Boy Who Never Slept, these are actually what you can only really call open source films, in that they make the source available. Elephant's Dream is an animation produced using Blender. And not only is the end result freely available, but you can take the raw Blender files and hack on them. So they're quite happy for you to hack on their sources. And similarly, Boy Who Never Slept, they have made available all the raw footage that has gone into this, and it's freely available for anyone to use in any way. So I think these are interesting examples of video open content. They're all covered by CC licenses. And then for audio, again, the Creative Commons has actually set up their own site called CC Mixter, where people are encouraged to download samples, rework them, and then upload them for other people to work on again. So it's a classic case of taking elements and contributing them back to the commons that you've got them from. So I think you can see that the open content idea is really starting to take off now, and a lot of that was driven by open source ideas. I put this here because I think this is a very interesting development in the last 6 months, a year, which is Second Life. Not sure how many people here have been to Second Life? One. Do the rest of you know what Second Life is? No?
Yes.
Okay, one or two days. I'll just explain quickly. It's basically a virtual world. You have a client that you use to log in to their servers, and you are represented by an avatar, in other words, a virtual presence there, and you can move around this virtual world. And what's most interesting about Second Life, and I think what distinguishes it from all of the online games, the various role-playing, massively online role-playing games, is the fact that you create your own content. In other words, you create a house in Second Life, and you not only can live there, and you can not only furnish it and do whatever you want, you own the intellectual property. So the company, which is Linden Labs, has explicitly renounced all claim to your intellectual property. And that's completely different from practically everyone else that I'm aware of who claim the intellectual property of anything you may do in their world. And therefore, this is really a unique example of a new kind of open content, in other words, open objects. And so I've put it down here that Second Life is really the old Web 1.0, in other words, just the World Wide Web. It's Web 2.0, because the whole point of much of Second Life is really interacting with other avatars there. So it's a kind of glorified IM, glorified chat rooms, glorified blogs. I mean, it's the whole kind of communications idea. But it's three-dimensional, and people are starting to call this Web 3.D as a kind of play on the Web 2.0 3D idea. And what's interesting, as I say, is that the content, the in-world content, is this... or sorry, can be open content. You're not forced to share it. You can claim your copyright in it. But the important thing is that Linden Labs are not imposing their copyright regimes on it. One of the most interesting things, probably from a programmer's viewpoint, or two really, one is that there's a scripting language associated with Second Life whereby you can associate a script with objects. And those scripts are basically the physics of that object, in other words, what that object does when you touch it or when you throw it or push it or whatever. And that's completely open, so you can click on an object and you can generally see that scripting language. So it's a bit like JavaScript. So again, it's a completely open world where you can see how other people have done things and you can basically cut and paste. I mean, it's part of the culture. Perhaps even more interestingly, you can do collaborative projects. In other words, you know, five avatars could pile in and start working on a Second Life spaceship, and they could all work on different bits of it at the same time. And I don't think really there's any other way of doing that. It's you really need the metaphor of space to work on these objects, and I think that's a very interesting idea, the fact that you can do this. So again, I think this is all very germane in terms of the ideas of open source. The other fascinating thing is that Second Life depends critically on open source. It's currently running on GNU Linux, Apache and Squid. The only reason it exists really is because it's scalable, because every square in the world of Second Life has a server associated with it, and that server handles all of the virtual reality in that square. So it's a completely distributed system that just interfaces between the squares. And the reason they can keep going without demanding that A, you give over your intellectual property, or B, that you even pay, you can actually join this without paying, is because Linden Labs sells virtual land. In other words, for somebody who wants to buy a luxurious island in the middle of their virtual sea, you have to pay them a certain amount of money and a certain amount of rent. And that money effectively covers the costs of the server. So it's kind of neutral in terms of the cost. When they expand Second Life, the cost is covered by the people who want it to expand. And so it's a bit like Google in some ways, that they just keep on lashing up more servers. And similarly, Second Life has this model whereby they can just keep throwing completely sort of bare bones GNU Linux systems, which again, you couldn't do if you had proprietary software. So their business model is intimately tied up with open source. And more than that, they have said consistently, they haven't done it yet, that they're going to move both the server and the client-side software to open source. So they'll open it up, which means that you'll be able to host your own servers, and then presumably there'll be some kind of portal between your world and their world. And so you have a multiply connected world. And the interesting thing is that you couldn't do this, you couldn't open source one of the competitive games, for example, because typically on the client side, the client knows things that you don't know. So it knows there are people around the corner. It knows something that it requires in terms of creating the world or creating the movement. So if you had an open source client in say, World of Warcraft, then basically you could cheat because you would know what's going to happen. But because this isn't a game, I mean, Second Life is not a game, it's a virtual reality. Therefore, there's no incentive to I mean, there's nothing to be gained by hacking the client, so they can make it open source. So it's an interesting marriage between the values of this particular world and of open source that isn't possible in other areas. Okay, so just summarising those here. Again, you've got less clean comparisons, really, like it's free, as in freedom sometimes. There is some global distributed net-based development, but the biggest difference is perhaps the Darwinian side. If you're dealing with open content, it's not clear what is better content. If you have a piece of text and somebody hacks on it, then there's no clear metric for deciding that's a better piece of text as there is when you're hacking on the kernel. But basically, if it does its job better, then you use it. But you don't have that Darwinian element. So the match between open source and open content is less good. But nonetheless, open source has had a profound influence on open content. I'd just like to conclude with a few comments about the challenges to the opens. In open genomics, there are still legal issues to do with patents. Just because the human genome was placed in the public domain didn't stop a lot of people patenting a lot of things, which will need legal challenges to clear out, basically. It's a very, very muddy area. There are multiple patents on bits of genes, and it's everybody's worst nightmare in terms of patents. Open access, interestingly, it's an economic challenge. The scientific, technical, and medical publishers obviously don't like open access, and they are starting to play Microsoft-type games trying to thwart it. For example, Elsevier, which you probably know, Reed Elsevier, is I think the biggest STM publisher. They have been doing a lot of political lobbying in Washington and in London. So given that they can't fight on technical grounds, they're really adopting political means to try and stymie the growth of open access. But I think, a bit like Microsoft, it's really just a question of time, because the dynamics are so favourable to open access that the scientists are just going to demand it. The public's going to demand it. Everybody apart from the publishers is going to demand it. On the open content side, as I've said before, one of the key things is coming up with tools that let you create open content and let you work on open content. So I think that coming up with new kinds of tools for open content is going to be quite a rich area. So it's interesting that the three areas I've concentrated on have quite distinct challenges facing them. Just to conclude, the open meme is really out of control now. So you've got what people are calling open science, which is kind of open access plus, and the plus is really open data, because even though open access is becoming increasingly common, a lot of data is still tied up. In other words, the scientists don't give up the data, and perhaps the worst example of that is to do with avian flu. You might think that scientists would be sort of swapping avian flu genomes with each other and saying, you know, have a look at this, what do you think? But in fact, they are by and large hoarding it on the grounds that they want to make sure that they get the first publication out of that data. So the fact it's going to take 2 years to go through the publication process and we might all be dead by that point doesn't really seem to have entered their minds. And the trouble is that the World Health Organization is essentially powerless, because it operates on the sort of approval of everybody else, so it can't get tough with sort of Indonesia or China or indeed America or the UK. It just has to ask very nicely, could you please open up the data? And there are some very slow moves towards that, but it's just extraordinary that this data by and large is not available to scientists around the world. So the scientist that does the genome sequencing, that lab tends to keep that data to itself, and so you've got all the worst problems of proprietary software, closed source, in one of the most critical areas today. So that's not particularly good news. Open journalism, this idea of citizen journalists who sort of do all the reporting, is getting quite popular in some areas. Open source marketing, I love the names of these things. Clutrain Manifesto, I'm sure you've come across, is quite old. Pinko Marketing is a bit more recent. And I discovered that Pinko Marketing has now branched off into the citizen agency, which is a kind of marketing agency that is supposed to represent the people, apparently, rather than the companies. But I'm not sure how that works. Open business is getting quite popular. The idea that businesses need to open up to their customers, and the use of corporate blogs and wikis. The wikis tend to be inside the firewall, but potentially you could even have some outside. And then finally, my favourite one really is open source conferences, which is where you basically all sit around in a circle with your laptops connected by Wi-Fi, and you're all blogging away on the conference blog and wikiing away on the conference wiki. And there's none of this nonsense where, you know, somebody stands up at the front and everyone just sits quietly there. So it's basically saying that we've all wasted our time for the last hour or so, and that you should be doing it a completely different way. So probably on that note, I'd like to throw it open to yourselves so we can get into this open source conferencing and ask if any questions or comments or anything.
One video is sort of glaring omission to me almost from that perspective.